Welcome you all to our second day of our arguments in the November calendar, and we have a special welcome for East Troy High School students. Would they please stand? Good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The high school students are here with us under our Court with Class program. This is a national award-winning, indeed several awards, for this program, and it is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the Wisconsin State Bar. Students from all over the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument, and when the invitation is accepted, we send the students your briefs. And they do work on this particular case. And then as part of that presentation, they will meet with a justice after the second oral argument, which is about 12 to 12:15. You are all invited to attend that discussion. It will focus on the processes of the court, not the substantive merits of the case. And today, presentation at noon will be made by Justice Wilcox, who is sitting to my immediate right. And seated to Justice Wilcox's right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to his right, Justice Patience Rogensack. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. Having made those introductions, we will turn to our first case this morning, which is 03-1621, Jessica Mayberry versus Volkswagen of America, Inc. Arguing for Volkswagen is Drew J. Cochran. Mr. Cochran. Now, you're going to be introduced by Attorney Matthew McClenahan.
That's the plaintiff's counsel.
Go ahead.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Drew Cochran, and I'm an attorney with the Madison Law Firm Stafford Rosenbaum. We represent the defendant in this case, Volkswagen of America, Inc. I'm joined at counsel table by attorney Bruce Hubricks. The sole issue in this case is whether the plaintiff, Jessica Mayberry, may continue to pursue her motor vehicle breach of warranty claim against Volkswagen even after she received more than fair market value for the vehicle when she traded it in. The obvious answer to this question is no. Because Mayberry received more than fair market value for the vehicle, she simply has no damages. And because she has no damages, she has no case. The facts in this case are simple and are undisputed. In 2000, Mayberry purchased a Volkswagen Jetta. The vehicle was covered by a 2-year or 24,000-mile limited warranty. Mayberry subsequently claimed to have experienced problems with the vehicle, which Volkswagen was allegedly unable to fix. Mayberry then brought suit under the Federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act. After bringing suit, she traded in the vehicle in 2002. She then amended her complaint to reference the fact that she had traded in the vehicle. At trade-in, Mayberry received $15,100 in value for the vehicle. The parties agree that this is well more than the vehicle's fair market value at that time. Before she traded it in, Mayberry had owned the vehicle for almost 2 years and had put over 32,000 miles on it. Therefore, she had expired the warranty. Additionally, Mayberry did not incur any repair costs during the time that she owned the vehicle. All costs for repairs were paid for by Volkswagen under the terms of the warranty. Accordingly, there is no dispute that Mayberry drove the subject vehicle for more than 32,000 miles in 2 years, thereby expiring the warranty. She did not incur any cost for repair, and that she traded in the vehicle for more than its fair market value. These facts simply prohibit Mayberry from pursuing a breach of warranty claim against Volkswagen, because she has no damages.
What is, counsel, what is the significance of the fact that it's more than 24,000 miles that she drove the car? Is there any legal significance to that?
The fact that she expired the warranty, I don't believe has any legal significance to this case. I think it does show, however, that she did get significant use out of the vehicle. I think one of the aspects of this case that plaintiff is pursuing is, for example, what about the time she spent while the vehicle was in the shop? Well, I think the fact that she was able to drive at 32,000 miles in less than 2 years shows that she was able to receive significant value and significant use out of the vehicle by driving it a significant amount. In contrast, for example, you have the Wisconsin Lemon Law. I think it's important to note that this case is not brought under Wisconsin's Lemon Law. Wisconsin's Lemon Law has allows plaintiff to recover significantly greater damages. She, in fact, would be able to recover twice the purchase price of the vehicle. A vehicle is a lemon in Wisconsin if it's out of service for 30 days within the first year. Presumably, had the vehicle been out of service for any significant period of time, or had the damages been significant enough that the vehicle was, in fact, a lemon, we would have seen a lemon law case. But we don't. We only have the Magnuson Moss case.
Mr. Cochran, can I interrupt you for a minute? As I listen to your argument, at least to this point, you seem to be ignoring the language of the statute. 402.7142 talks in terms of the time and place of acceptance, and you're focusing on the trade-in. Now, why aren't you talking to us about the time and place of acceptance? That's what the statute talks about.
Sure. Justice Crooks is referencing the Uniform Commercial Code, and that is the proper measure of damages in a Magnuson Moss case. And the justice is correct that the base measure of damages, you are supposed to look at the vehicle's value as of the date and time of acceptance. However, that statute concludes by saying, unless special circumstances show proximate damages of a different amount.
What special circumstances do you think exist here?
We believe that the fact that she was able to receive more than fair market value for the vehicle when she traded it in constitutes that special circumstance. The circumstances in this case is that she's not harmed. She received more than fair market value for the vehicle after driving it a significant amount and getting a significant use out of the vehicle.
But doesn't that seem to emasculate the earlier provisions of the section? In other words, if you're supposed to focus on the time and place of acceptance, if we interpret special circumstances as you're asking us to, it seems to me that we're basically eliminating the first part of that statute.
Justice Crooks, I think you have to look at the statute as a whole. First, you have the special circumstances clause, which we're asking you to interpret today. Second, you have the first part of that same statutory section, which states that damages can be determined, quote, in any manner which is reasonable. Additionally, in the introduction to this Uniform Commercial Code section, you have it states that the remedies provided by the Uniform Commercial Code shall be liberally administered to the end that the aggrieved party may be put in as good a position as if the other party had fully performed. Now, that section has been interpreted to mean that the UCC damages statute is to give the buyer the benefit of the bargain, nothing more, nothing less.
Now, what section are you quoting?
That's WSSTAT section 401.106.
Thank you.
So if the whole idea is to give the buyer the benefit of the bargain, nothing more, nothing less, then we assert that that is exactly what has happened in this case. She has received the benefit of the bargain. She was able to drive the vehicle 32,000 miles for 2 years, and she received more than fair market value for when she traded it in. If you were then to allow her to get additional damages, she would, in fact, be in a much better position than she would have. She would not just get the benefit of the bargain. She would get much greater than the benefit of the bargain. And that is exactly why you have to stop her from or cease her ability to bring this claim.
Counselor, but, you know, if we're supposed to look at the value of the car at the date of acceptance, that's when she received it and took possession of it. If she had a car that was constantly a pain in the neck during the initial 2 years or almost 2 years that she owned the car, say up to 24,000 miles, because she ran the warranty before the time limit ran, during the warranty period, don't you kind of read out that annoyance that's the statute is supposed to compensate for if you only look at what happened down the road and don't look at the consistent problems with the car from the time she took possession?
I'm sorry, Justice.
I lost
it. I don't
quite understand. Too long of a question. Let me try again. My concern is that the Magnuson Warranty Act talks about a warranty that's established when you take possession of the car. Okay? You are focusing our attention down the road when it was traded in. And you're saying she got fair value by the trade-in. But you are not focusing at all on any diminution in value that was present on the date of acceptance. And that's the problem that I'm having, is your focus is down the road, and it seems to have no focus at the beginning of the transaction, which is what the statute tells us to look at. Why are you able to shift the time frame for valuation? What are you relying on for that shift?
I'd answer that in a couple of ways. First of all, the value of the vehicle at the time she takes it is $17,800, just like any other Volkswagen Jetta that she would have bought at that time. And the warranty is what allows Volkswagen to sell essentially similar vehicles for essentially the same price over the course of 6 to 12 months while that vehicle is being sold. So the value of the vehicle at the time she gets it with that warranty is $17,800.
All right.
When you talk about what allows us to get further down the road, those are the things I used to address Justice Crooks's section. When you read the statute as a whole, you have the special circumstances clause. You have a section of the statute which states you can look at damages, you can use any measure which is reasonable.
But none of those refer to at the time of acceptance. I mean, are you telling me that special circumstances has a temporal component? So if there's a different value down the road, I don't have to consider what the value was at the time of acceptance?
In this case, she drove the vehicle for 32,000 miles, got rid of it, and received more than fair market value. So at this time, she simply has no damages.
But she received more 2 years down the road. What bothers me is the time element. I mean, she received more 2 years down the road, and I can understand your saying at that point in time, she got fair market for the car. But what about the value between $17,800 and the $15,100 that she apparently got it traded?
Again, we believe that's why we have the special circumstances clause. That's why that clause is in there, to make an exception when there are facts which don't fit neatly into the situation. I think if you look only at the initial sale price, in addition to what I used to answer Justice Crooks's question, you're also completely eliminating the plaintiff's duty to mitigate her damages. In this case, the law worked exactly the way it's supposed to work. She had a car. She probably may have had damages had the vehicle been in a bad condition, as she alleges that it is, but she went out and was able to get rid of the vehicle and receive more than fair market value for it. That's her duty to mitigate her damages.
What about if she kept the car for 5 years? She couldn't afford to buy a new trade-in, and she kept the car for 5 years, and at 5 years she got whatever the value of the car would be then. You're telling me still she has no damage from the date of purchase to the date of trade-in just because she got 5 years later what that car was worth 5 years later?
The warranty would have been long expired.
I understand that, and I know that the damages occurred during the warranty period, okay? So here the damages occurred before the trade-in. You could push it out 5 years. They'd still occur before the trade-in, right?
I think if she is able to use the vehicle, which she was in this case, and if she receives more than value for the vehicle when she gets rid of it, then yes, she has no damages.
Counsel, excuse me.
That's fine. We're just arguing with each other, but I don't think we're shedding any light on the problem.
Well, I think Your concern is, now this was a summary judgment. Judge Frelick granted summary judgment. It was reversed by the Court of Appeals. So basically we take it back to the trial court. Trial court seemed to say that the sufficiency of the evidence that Ms. Mayberry put in was not sufficient, and I think that's the basis we have to look at. In other words, summary judgment said there wasn't any material facts in issue here. I'm going to decide it as you have so presented here very ably, that, look, she bought a car for $17,800, got $15,100, therefore she didn't suffer any damages. But I think under the law that a person like Ms. Mayberry can testify or submit an affidavit that says that whatever she thinks the value of the vehicle was at the time she purchased it. That's what the law, that's what the statute seems to say. Do you disagree with that?
No, I do not.
Okay. So that, the issue here, if I must say, is, well, first of all, what should we do with the summary judgment? But should she have been able to put that in? And here, Judge Freilich said basically, well, I'm not going to accept that. And I think, isn't it true under the law of the state of Wisconsin that an owner can testify as to the value of their property just by putting a figure in? Is that the law or not?
Someone who has owned a product for a certain period of time.
Well, let's just take Ms. Mayberry.
Yes, she is allowed to submit her opinion on what the vehicle is worth. That's correct.
Yes, and she did that.
Yes.
And despite that, the judge said, well, there aren't any material facts that are an issue. In other words, I'm going to grant judgment despite the fact that she put in what she thought the value. So that's what we're looking at, aren't we? You're saying there was enough there for him to decide, but the decision basically here is, well, are we going to allow that testimony to come in or not?
I'll answer that two ways. First of all, and I think her affidavit stated her belief that the vehicle was worth about
$12,526.
And I'll answer that two ways. First of all, I think that while someone can testify as to what they think the value of something is that they own, I think there has to be some basis for that. She's saying that when the car was brand new, it was only worth $12,500. She subsequently owns it for 2 years, drives it 32,000 miles, and then it's worth $15,100. To me, that does not make any sense. And I think
that may be true, but the law of the state is is, you're familiar with the A.O. Smith case, the 1991 case, the Harvestor case that allowed someone to come in and he or she had bought a Harvestor that, holds a silage. And they testified at the time they bought the Harvestor, which is one of these big blue tubes put in the barnyard, that it was worth nothing. And that was upheld. So, as I say, isn't that the law, that a property owner can testify without the use of experts, just what they feel the property is worth?
Yes, I do agree that that's the law. And as much as I think that her affidavit is wrong, maybe it's right. Maybe that vehicle was only worth $12,500. But she managed to get someone to pay her $15,100 for it. And that's what important in this case. The vehicle could have been worth nothing. But if someone gives her $15,100 for it, then she's mitigated her damages regardless of what the actual value of the vehicle was. And that's why I think her affidavit isn't necessarily relevant in this case, because even if she's correct, she still was able to get someone to pay her more than fair market value. And that's what's important in this case.
I understand that.
But I guess the question I have is how you get to no damages from there. Let me ask you a question. Is 15 U.S.C. Section 2304 Paragraph A, paragraph 4, which is on page 4 of the Court of Appeals decision, cited in page 4 of the Court of Appeals decision in 104 of your appendix in this case. Does that apply here?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the statutory section?
15 U.S.C. Section 2304, paragraph A, paragraph 4, which is cited on page 4 of the Court of Appeals opinion. Does that section apply? And specifically, if I'm reading correctly, if the product or component part thereof contains a defect or malfunction, after a reasonable number of attempts by the warranter to remedy defects or malfunctions in such product, such warranter must permit the consumer to elect either a refund or a replacement part without charge, such product or part, as the case may be.
That does not apply, Justice Butler, and because the difference, this gets into a little bit of minutia which wasn't briefed in our or wasn't addressed in our briefs, but the Court of Appeals is wrong in that case. That section applies to full warranties. The warranty in this case is a limited warranty. And we raised that issue in a reconsideration motion to the Court of Appeals to try to have them address that error in their opinion. And that reconsideration motion was not granted, but I think that that reconsideration motion is likely in the appendix, and you would be able to read our brief on that at that stage.
So you don't want us to consider it?
To be honest, I'm not convinced it's relevant one way or another, but the fact it's relevant to the extent that she is not entitled to return the vehicle and is not entitled to a refund of full purchase price.
She didn't elect a refund, is she?
She does not have the option to elect a refund.
I know, but she hasn't.
I believe that she did attempt to return the vehicle at some point, but she did not specifically state that she would like a refund for the vehicle.
Didn't she attempt to revoke her acceptance of the vehicle?
She did, but again, that's not a remedy which is available to her under the Magnuson-Moss Act.
No, I understand that you're disagreeing with that remedy, but did she attempt to do that, though?
Yes.
All right.
Is that an issue in this case, and we're going to ask the other side, too?
I don't believe that it is.
All right.
There is some case law in this area, although it is admittedly limited. First of all, there is an Illinois case, Valenti versus Mitsubishi Motor Sales.
Before you get to the case law, I just have some problems with exactly what is admitted here and whether or not there's any dispute as to the facts. That's, you have to have no dispute about material facts, right?
Pardon me?
To get summary judgment, there has to be no dispute about material facts, okay? So when I read this, I was somewhat perplexed that the value of this car was the $17,000 plus when the actual payment was $22,000 or whatever it was, $1,000 plus. You know, if you buy a new car, she had to buy a new car to replace that, it wouldn't be $17,000, it'd be another $22,000 because there are all these carrying charges. And when you say that the value of the car was blue book value or whatever the appropriate term is now, $14,000 plus, and she got $15,000 plus, I don't find that too persuasive either because a lot of times a dealer will give you a large amount on the trade-in, but what they're doing is just charging you more for the new car. So, and they would have given you, charge you less for the new car if you didn't have the trade-in. So it all just sort of averages or at least washes out. So are all of these figures binding on these parties, or if it goes back on remand, do we start again on the, because this is all affidavit?
Chief Justice, you're assuming a lot of facts which
That's
simply
right.
aren't in the record.
That's right.
And plaintiff's counsel, if she wanted to raise an issue as to whether or not she did receive more or less than, or whether or not the $15,000 is a phantom $15,000, she had an obligation to do that at summary judgment stage, and she did not.
Okay. So if it should be remanded, isn't that what the Court of Appeals did here, remand this case?
Yes.
All right. When it gets back, is everybody bound by the numbers that we have?
Plaintiff's counsel has conceded in a letter to the court at the summary judgment stage that she received more than fair market value for the vehicle. So I think that they are bound by that at this time.
All right. Thank you. Now you may proceed with the cases.
Is there any dispute about the $17,800 as a figure that everybody should be working from?
That is the base cash price that she paid for the vehicle is $17,800. There are additional taxes and things like that that Chief Justice referenced. I think it's important to note, however, when you trade in a vehicle, you only, say you buy a vehicle for $20,000 and you get $10,000 in trade, you only pay sales tax on the difference, that $10,000. So it's not as if she trades it in and pays double sales tax because she gets credit for all the sales tax she paid previously. So those charges that she would have had on top of the $17,800 are charges that she's going to have no matter what she buys, and she's not going to necessarily be paying double for them, with the possible exception of, for example, the title charges. Again, however, those are...
You just lost me. 17.8 to 22 suggests more than taxes, because taxes isn't going to get you to 22. So
part of the finance.
Is that the... Oh, I'm sorry. Does that include the financing charges?
Yeah.
Well, the finance.
If that includes the financing charges, that
it does. That includes the total over the life of the loan.
I've got it now. All right.
We're dealing with the Uniform Commercial Code. What is the special circumstances? How has that been interpreted all over the country?
The special circumstances clause has not been interpreted in many jurisdictions. There is not a lot of case law interpreting the special circumstances language at all. There is one case out of Alabama that we cite, the Harlan case, which talks about that the owner of a motor home is able to, it says that the use of the product over time constitutes a special circumstance. The facts of that case aren't exactly the same as the facts of our case, but again, that language is there. Additionally, there's a case out of Pennsylvania, the Price case, and the Price case cites the Kruger case out of Pennsylvania. And in the Kruger case, it states that the plaintiff is not entitled to full recovery where she used the car for 8 months, thereby depreciating the warranty. So there is, while there is not a breadth of case law, there certainly is some case law in this area that we think we can rely on to show that this is the sort of fact situation where we can get into that special circumstances clause.
Isn't the problem, I'll go back, the problem is that what the opposing counsel is saying is that the wrong measure of damages was used here. In other words, the judge did not allow, there are competing facts, and this is a summary judgment. So that's what, you'll have an opportunity to argue these things perhaps back if it goes back to the trial court. But right now, the argument is basically that whether the legal sufficiency of the evidence to support the damages. In other words, you look at the statute, which is 402.7142. It talks about the measure of damages. Now, that's what the appellate court is saying. It wasn't used by the trial judge. Do you disagree with that?
I think similar to what happened in the Valente case, it's referenced in passing, but it certainly is not analyzed with any specificity. But again, the facts aren't in dispute. The fact that you're talking about is her affidavit. And again, as Chief Justice, I'm sorry.
Okay, no, I'm talking about how the court measured the damages. There's a specific statute that says this is how you do it. And the other side, your opposing counsel said you didn't. The trial judge did not do it that way. He did not measure it the way it's supposed to be done under 402.7142. Therefore, there's a material issue of fact that was left hanging at the trial court. And that's more or less what the Court of Appeals said.
I would assert that there's not any issues as to any material fact. And I would assert that it's the Court of Appeals' job and this Court to apply in this case a set of facts which are uncontroverted, apply the law to those set of facts. I would assert that that is this court's job, and that's not necessarily the trial court's job. And if the trial court made an error applying the law to undisputed facts, that's the job of this court to correct that court. In conclusion, Justices, Jessica Mayberry purchased a vehicle, owned it for almost 2 years, drove it for 32,000 miles, eventually incurred no – I'm sorry.
You may complete your sentence and thought.
Thank you. She incurred no repair costs. She subsequently traded in the vehicle for more than its fair market value. These facts prohibit her from pursuing a breach of warranty claim against Volkswagen because she simply has no damages. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now, Mr. Cohn – from Chicago, is not a member of the bar. And you will be asking for pro hoc vici status. Okay, please take the podium.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Matthew McClenahan. I'm a Wisconsin licensed attorney from the law firm of Cronin Moss in Chicago, Illinois. I'm here today to present to you Mr. Scott Cohen. Mr. Scott Cohen is authorized to practice before the highest court, the states of Illinois and Indiana. He's here today to present the argument of plaintiff appellant, Ms. Jessica Mayberry.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cohen, you're admitted to practice before this court for the next 30 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel, good morning, Your Honors. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. There is one thing that I agree with my opponent, Mr. Cochran. There is no issue with respect to genuine issues of fact in this case. And that is because the only issue, or the only facts for that matter, that were presented to demonstrate damages in this case are the facts that were presented by Jessica Mayberry. Jessica Mayberry's affidavit demonstrating, in accordance with the law of this state, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in two separate cases in Wilbershide, as well as in the tribal matter, has indicated that an owner of an an owner of property, for that matter, may testify to the value of their product. That is what Jessica Mayberry did. She offered an affidavit attesting to her opinion as to how much she overpaid for the vehicle at the time and place of acceptance, in conformity with the language of the commercial code.
And
that
was
is where
how
you
much?
Measure damages.
How much?
She attested that she paid $12,526. That figure is $6,000 less than the purchase price with sales tax and with the registration fees, or roughly she is attesting that she should have only have paid two-thirds of the price of her vehicle as opposed to the full purchase price in light of the problems that she experienced. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You didn't. It seems to fly in the face of common sense to me to say that, and I don't disagree with what you're saying about the measure of damages, but when you talk about what you paid for a car and what you received for it, whether it's traded in or not, you're saying that any of that, any of those figures could not be used at summary judgment? Is that what you're saying?
The amount that she received for the vehicle when she traded it in is certainly relevant, but not relevant to her damages. It's relevant to show the condition of the vehicle, for instance, and that is something that the Illinois Court of Appeals in the Bartow opinion referenced. It's relevant for that purpose. It's relevant to show circumstantially whether or not the vehicle was of the level of quality that the plaintiffs alleged. But that's an issue for another day. That's not the issue that was raised in the summary judgment motion. However, it bears little relevance to the measure of damages at the time and place of acceptance. And unless this court accepts Volkswagen's theory, and a theory, mind you, that has not been adopted by any court in this country, the theory, and that includes as well the Valenti opinion that it relies upon, the theory that you should obviate the base measure of damages at the time and place of acceptance, but rather look at special circumstances to measure them at a different time, unless this court adopts that theory, then the only measure of damages in this record is the affidavit of Jessica Mayberry.
Well, let me ask you then, because I want to ask you the same question I asked of Mr. Cochran, and I want to know if you agree with him. Is it your position that 15 U.S.C. section 2304 sub A sub 4 does not apply here?
I agree. I suppose there's a second point that I agree with Mr. Cochran. It does not apply. The warranty in this case was a limited warranty. That section applies only to full warranties. The plain language of the Warranty Act under section 2310D indicates that you should look to state law to determine other legal and equitable relief that would be available. The United States Circuit Courts that have interpreted Magnuson Moss have said that that is why you must use the commercial code to determine the measure of damages.
And that's what you're saying, is that the trial judge did not use the correct measurement of damages. In other words, now, assuming that's true and assuming whatever decision this court is going to make, if the case were to go back, my question is, there's nothing to stop opposing counsel from using those facts in a trial. Is there, as far as the facts that they want to present?
There is nothing to stop them from arguing to the jury that the number that my client attests to that she would have paid for the vehicle is astoundingly low. And in fact, if I had to choose which side I would like to be arguing this case to the jury, I would probably pick Volkswagen's side.
Well,
but that goes to the sufficiency of the evidence.
I understand. I think I asked opposing counsel that question, but it seems to me that then in reality, that as long as the owner comes in and testifies to whatever, which seems to be and is the law of the state of Wisconsin, that you're very seldom going to get a summary judgment motion unless this court were to set a different standard. I mean, the statutory standard is there as far as a measure of damages, and that's what you're asking us to apply.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, and Mr. Cochran did concede, that is the law in the state of Wisconsin. He did not, at the trial court level, attack in any way my client's opinion that she should have only have paid $12,000, but rather Volkswagen's approach was simply, that's irrelevant. Let's look at how much she received subsequently, and when the vehicle was resold, it was resold for more than fair market value.
But, Counselor, doesn't the fact that she received more than fair market value as a trade-in create the inference that her testimony about what the car was worth at acceptance is open to question? And if the inference from the trade-in is created as I've referenced to you, don't we have to send it back for trial, even if we agree with your theory that Volkswagen can't prevail out of hand?
It may create the inference. And this court in 1969 in the tribal matter said that that goes to the weight and the sufficiency of the evidence, the opinion, the layperson opinion of somebody as to their value.
But we don't decide weight questions on summary judgment.
I agree. And I don't believe that summary judgment should have been granted. And accordingly, the appellate court's decision, it is our contention, was proper.
But when you said to me there's no material issue of fact. And
we're not asking for summary judgment. And the reason why we're not asking for summary judgment is because the issue of damages is something that historically, from the plaintiff's point of view, is not something that you could move forward and get summary judgment on unless the other side is conceding that, in fact, that was the diminished value of the vehicle. And Volkswagen is not making that concession. When I said there's no issue of fact, what I meant was there's no evidence in the record other than plaintiff's evidence as to what the diminished value of the vehicle was at the time of sale. That is the only evidence in the record. The trial court disregarded that. And when the trial court did so, the trial court did not do so applying the special circumstances prong of Section 2714 of the Commercial Code. In fact, Volkswagen never even referenced the special circumstances prong to the trial court.
So you just want us to send it back. You're not asking that we use these facts and these facts alone to come to some bottom line conclusion.
Absolutely not. I agree that there are issues of fact that the jury should properly determine. There is no issue at this stage, however, as to what the evidence as to what the diminished value of the vehicle is, because the only evidence in the record is plaintiff's evidence. But that is something that the jury should decide. And jurors are appropriate to determine damages. That has traditionally been the law of the land, that jurors determine what damages are. And although Volkswagen is free to dispute that at the trial court level, at the summary judgment level, they did not come forward with an affidavit saying that at the time and place of acceptance, the value of this vehicle was diminished. Rather, all they did was rely upon pages out of a blue book or another evaluation guide to show that the amount of money that my client received for the vehicle 2 years after purchase, 2 years after experiencing all the problems of the vehicle, was more than what would be considered fair market value.
Counsel, you allege, and since we're getting into this, or at least in my opinion, you say in your brief that your client can recover cover damages, they can recover incidental consequential damages, and I didn't see that. There was no testimony to that. Are you saying when you go back to the trial court, you're going to be able to do that?
It is our contention that what my client did essentially defines cover. We did not ask for cover, and the reason why we didn't ask for cover was frankly because my client bought a vehicle that was a $25,000 Mazda Tribute, different type of vehicle. And although I still think that that is an issue of whether or not cover was effectuated reasonably, we didn't ask for it. The reason why we reference cover and the reason why I think it is important that this court realize that this is an available remedy to a consumer is because obviously this court is going to want to create a uniform rule in accordance with the Uniform Commercial Code, something that can be applied to all commercial transactions. If we accept Volkswagen's theory that if you trade in a product or sell a product and get fair market value for it, you'll be effectively doing away with a remedy under the Commercial Code of cover. Very often when goods are resold.
Counsel, will you define cover for us, please?
Sure. Cover is where you purchase replacement goods for the goods that have deemed to have been defective. And then in turn, you may mitigate by reselling the goods that you claim to be defective or the goods that you claim to be subject of the breach.
And you're not claiming cover damages here.
We're not claiming cover damages, but I think it's important to reference why, however, we talk about it in our brief. And the reason we talk about it is imagine if this transaction did not involve an automobile, but say rather involved a sweater or a toaster. The resale market for used toasters or used sweaters is going to be de minimis. I'm sure you've seen the tables in the IRS code that talk about how much you can get when you write off, for instance, an article of clothing. And maybe you spend $50 on a sweater. The IRS is going to let you recover a dollar for it. If you were to sell it at a garage sale, you might get a dollar for your sweater. Now, imagine the same consumer who sells the sweater at the garage sale for the dollar because when they bought the sweater, got it home and realized it was defective and it was falling apart, sues for breach of warranty. The defendant comes in, like in here, in this case, and says, well, wait a second. The market for your sweater was only 50 cents, and you got $2 for it when you sold it at the garage sale. Therefore, you are not damaged. If we accept Volkswagen's theory and we apply it uniformly to all goods, in that situation, the buyer of this sweater, where the sweater fell apart that spent $50 on it, is not going to be able to recover at all.
It would seem to me, counsel, and I think the question that Justice Crook asked is a very good one, because it would seem to me that the cover argument would want to be argued by the other side in the sense that the issue here, and I understand this applies to all goods. I would say that motor vehicles or trucks fall into a little different category because there is a, quote, ready market out there which exists in the used, whether it's trade-in, whether it's sold to a private party. So that argument would be seemingly available, not necessarily to both sides, at time of trial.
Absolutely. And frankly, if Volkswagen had argued that, there's an application to the formula. The United States Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, in the case of Gardensky-Leszczyk versus Ford Motor Company, detailed what that formula was. And they said that to measure damages in a cover scenario, you take the cost of the replacement goods, less the value of the goods as they are sold or returned to, in that case it was returned to the manufacturer, less a reasonable offset for the use of the goods. If we apply those figures here, what we would have would be the $25,000 for the cost of the replacement vehicle, less the $15,000 that my client received on trade, then less some reasonable offset for the 32,000 miles that my client put on the car. If Volkswagen were to argue that, to say that this demonstrates that your damages are limited, I would 100% agree. We didn't advance the cover theory for the reasons that I stated, however. The question is, did my client cover reasonably? And realizing that that was a tough road ahead, we didn't advance it. I reference it only to demonstrate how, if you accept Volkswagen's theory, that you will be doing away with that concept for all goods. Now, getting back to the special...
If you put aside the matter of cover, do you accept the $17,800 figure?
I am willing to accept it because I don't think it matters, frankly. The value of the goods is warranted, whether it be $17,800, whether it be $18,526 with sales tax, or whether it be $22,000 with finance charges. No matter which figure you use, the fact of the matter is that my client testified in an affidavit, appropriately so, that she should not have paid what she paid for the vehicle, establishing prima facie evidence of her damages, establishing evidence that was unrefuted in the record and not contested. So no matter what basis point you use, there is still evidence in the record to establish damages.
Well, let me just say, if we were working from $17,800, I don't quite understand how you're measuring from the date that the sale is made. How do you... what's the other part? What do you subtract from that? You've got the broken armrest, you've got the oil, you've got the light. How do you value that? I suppose you can do it by the affidavit from the purchaser. But if you're in trial, I think you want a little bit more than that. How do you do that?
It is inherently a subjective evaluation, a speculative evaluation. The plain language of the code requires you go back to the time and place of acceptance. New goods, I'll stick to automobiles. There is no evaluation guide that will tell you the value of a brand new car in a defective state. They don't exist. You are required by hindsight to go back to that moment in time and to consider all of the problems that you had to factor into your eventual opinion of how much you overpaid. Something that the Supreme Court of the state of South Carolina in the case of Durant versus Palmetto recognized. The court said that damages under the commercial code require a hindsight analysis, requires you to go back and to speculate. Now, as to the opinion, that is something that is certainly up to attack. That is something that Volkswagen can stand before the jury and say, what does she know about automobiles? How can she say she would have only have paid this? However, jurors, just like your honors, are educated consumers. They know how much they pay for goods. And if you were to have the benefit of your crystal ball and to look at this Volkswagen with all of the repair receipts taped to the window on the date that you bought it, and you were able to say, you know what, I'm going to buy this car and it's going to be in the shop five times for engine problems, eventually leading up to a significant engine repair to the pistons. It's going to be out of service for 10 days. Am I going to spend the $17,800 for the vehicle, or am I going to buy the vehicle for a lesser amount?
Okay. So she says that it was worth how much when she bought it?
She says that she should have paid two-thirds of its value, or $12,526.
Okay. Where, two-thirds of what?
Two-thirds of what she actually paid.
Which is that $22,000, $18,000, or
$17,000? Her affidavit bases the figure on the $18,526. Which is the price with the sales tax.
With the sales tax, right.
Correct. Okay. And that is her opinion, and that's the only evidence in the record as to how much she should have overpaid, something that this court in the tribal matter.
Counsel, I want to ask, so she can testify to that. I'm just wondering, now that we know that summary judgment was granted, there's no evidence in the record about anything else, can she testify that, I'm just going to make this up, all right, I was down for 10 days, and whatever I... What did she do in those 10 days? Did she rent a vehicle? Can she testify as to she wasn't able to take her mother to the doctor? Can she testify to those things or not?
She can. In her affidavit, she didn't.
She didn't in her affidavit. And isn't that where the evidence, that's it here. You're going to say she can extend and identify these issues to the jury then?
Certainly. If there's an issue of disclosure, and Volkswagen wants to raise that at trial, and I don't think that there will be, because the repair records on their face demonstrate the day the car was brought in and brought out.
I think everybody probably, certainly on this court, has had a time when their car has been in repair. Now, whether it's been, but there's always something that you were going to do. You have to either get another vehicle, you have to walk, you have to borrow your neighbor's car, you have to do something. And that's what I'm getting at. That she'd be able to testify to those incidents.
Absolutely. The fact that we did not raise it at the summary judgment level doesn't mean that it cannot be raised later. It just means that for purposes of this court's analysis, this court frankly shouldn't consider it if she did not testify as to what she did during the 10 days.
Well, that's what I meant by incidental and consequential. The damages that flowed out of this difficulty that she had with the vehicle.
In the record are the repair records that show the fact that the car was out of service.
I know that what's in the record.
What she did during that time, that's not in the record. Is she going to be able to go back and testify? I don't see any reason why the summary judgment motion and the context of her affidavit would confine her to only offer testimony as to what is contained within her affidavit. However, to go back and to be able to further explain her damages when, frankly, by simply giving an opinion as to the diminished value of the vehicle should have ended the summary judgment inquiry, I can't see any reason why she shouldn't be able to do that.
Counsel, I want to make sure that I understand. Now, with regard to Justice Wilcox, you're saying, as you did in your brief, that there may be incidental and consequential damages above and beyond what we're talking about here today. I was not certain of your response to Justice Prosser. When you said, as I heard it, I don't care if you use the 17,000 figure or the 18,000 figure with the sales tax or the 22,000 figure with the finance charge. Were you saying that you don't care with regard to this summary judgment motion only? I mean, because obviously there has to be another figure upon which you then can compute the difference between the 12,500 from the figure higher than that. So you care, but just not for purposes of this summary judgment motion that's before the court.
That's right, Justice Bradley. Mm-hmm. When I said I didn't care, I meant it only in the arena of we have evidence of damages. Of course, in presenting this case to the jury, I would like to use the higher figure. There's case law from throughout the country, as well as if you look at Amjur on sales, that talks about when you compute what is the value of the product is warranted, you add in the collateral charges, such as the finance charges. If I was presenting this case, I would be trying to get my client the maximum recovery. However, in an effort to demonstrate that even if you use the lowest figure, the $17,000 figure, even using that figure, there is still evidence in the record of damages. So no matter which figure you use as your basis point, there's still evidence of damages for purposes of summary judgment. As to what the jury does with it, what the trial court allows the jury to determine as to what is the basis point, that's an issue, I believe, for another day.
Mr. Cohen, I like jury trials. But there are some cases that don't seem to be natural candidates for jury trials. This doesn't strike me as one of those cases where the parties would want to spend the cost for a jury trial. How should this be handled so that it can be correctly settled by the court?
This court is required to come up with a general rule of law. Although the facts of this case, and I agree, Justice Prosser, the facts of this case are not particularly favorable to Jessica Mayberry, I believe it would be inappropriate for this court to use these particular facts to create a general rule of law for all consumers that where they eventually resell their goods and receive fair market value for them, that they are barred from going forward. I think that would be a substantial injustice to the Commercial Code, to the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, and there would be no reason for it to be done, as Volkswagen has not been able to advance and articulate a reason as to why you should be looking at the subsequent theory other than the simple shock appeal, for lack of a better term. The number is a large number that my client received on resale. But why should she not get the benefit of the good deal she negotiated when she resold the vehicle?
I just want to ask, it came in the Valenti case, which asked, and this raised this question. I could find no case out there other than the ones that were recited here that would deal any other way with the UCC and the damage question. Your opposing counsel says, well, look at Valenti. When I looked at Valenti and I looked at both Bartow, now you say, but neither one, I may be wrong, were a UCC case. They didn't mention the UCC. So am I right or wrong on that?
Justice Wilcox, I think you are incorrect, and let me tell you why. Yeah. First of all, in the Valenti decision, the issue that was before the court, and this is something I know something about, is the Valenti decision was a case that I handled. In Valenti, the issue before the court was a statutory issue, whether or not Section 2304B of the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act prohibits someone from bringing a claim because of the return requirement in the act where they disposed of their goods. What the Valenti court did was, is that they said, and to quote the court, we conclude that we need not reach the questions raised after reviewing the record. They bypassed that issue.
Okay.
And what they said was, is that we have to look at, in the record, is there any evidence of damages? Because Mitsubishi, in their response to summary judgment, attached an affidavit of a sales manager of a dealership saying, your client received fair market value, And because the plaintiff did not advance any theory of damages under the commercial code, and the Valenti
Court. I guess that's what I was saying.
Right. The Valenti Court says you have to demonstrate what your theory of damages is. Because the plaintiff in Valenti did not advance any theory whatsoever of damages, the Court said this was your time to do it. You didn't come forward with an affidavit. You didn't come forward with anything. You just simply have, and all we have in the record is this uncontested affidavit that fair market value was received. And I think that that was really incidental to the Court's eventual holding. The Court's holding was you must establish damages. That wasn't done. The Court in Bartow, and although the Court in Bartow doesn't mention Valenti specifically, the Court in Bartow, what they did was is that they said, in determining the issue of standing and whether or not there is a present injury, we must look to the available damages. And the Court said that the law of the UCC was the appropriate law to determine the measure of damages. It is in that opinion where you see the Illinois Appellate Court explaining and relying on Amgeron sales that the amount of money that someone resells their goods for is of no consequence to the base measure of damages under the commercial code. What somebody is able to get, whether it be due to an advance in the market or whether it be due to some pre-existing contract, has no consequence or no relevance to the base measure of damages at the time and place of acceptance, which leads me back to how do we get away from that. The only way that Volkswagen can win this appeal is if Volkswagen convinces this Court that special circumstances must be used to determine the measure of damages at some moment other than the time and place of acceptance. Volkswagen, in doing so, in making this argument, is disregarding the purpose as to why special circumstances was placed into the commercial code. Volkswagen cited Section 1-106 of the commercial code with respect to how remedies are to be administered. They're to be administered liberally. If you look at the official comment to the commercial code under Section 2-7192 of the commercial code, it talks about that there being at least minimum adequate remedies available to the consumer or to the buyer, for that matter. What minimum adequate remedies is Volkswagen trying to advance here? They're trying to essentially turn on its head the language of the commercial code to afford a buyer a remedy, to take away the remedy, to use this special circumstance, as it calls it, to eliminate someone's remedy where, as Volkswagen puts it, they have mitigated their damages to zero. If you look at the case law historically where special circumstances have been applied, for instance, the case of New York versus Pullman, the United States Second Circuit, the Court talks about applying special circumstances where proximate damages are greater than the base measure of damages under the commercial code. It talks about where there are inadequate remedies at law. It doesn't talk about, and there's no case for that matter, including the seven or so cases that Volkswagen relies upon, advancing a special circumstances theory, that say you should be using this prong to eliminate someone's damages. That's what Volkswagen is effectively trying to do.
Could I ask, what did Volkswagen do wrong here? I mean, I'm having a little trouble getting worked up about their bad conduct. I'm not quite sure I see any bad conduct here.
It is our contention that Volkswagen failed to repair our client's vehicle after a reasonable amount of time. The repair records show approximately 9 months from the moment that my client first tendered the vehicle for repair for problems with the engine till eventually the piston rings in the engine were replaced pursuant to a bulletin that Volkswagen had issued to all of its dealers, that it failed to repair the vehicle within a reasonable amount of time. This Court in Murray versus Holiday Rambler talked about the duty of reasonableness, that a warrantor, when their exclusive remedy in their warranty is to repair or replace, that they have a duty of reasonableness to repair the product within a reasonable amount of time. It is our contention that they did not. Now, whether or not the jury accepts that is a question for the jury, something that this Court in Murray made plain. Those are usually issues that the jury determines, reasonableness. Did Volkswagen repair the vehicle within a reasonable amount of time? Something that Volkswagen did not advance in their motion for summary judgment. In fact, that is something that the appellate court in its decision recognized. They said perhaps as to whether or not there is a breach is something that the trial court should be determining. However, Volkswagen didn't move forward on that theory. And I think that if they did, that the same result should be achieved here, that there are issues of fact as to reasonableness.
What kind, and I'm going to ask Mr. Cochran on his rebuttal. I have two questions for you. One, what kind of opinion, just outline the opinion you expect from this court. And two, what are there any errors, weaknesses, or changes you'd make to the Court of Appeals opinion?
Chief Justice, the opinion that I would ask this court to issue is to recognize that the base measure of damages under the commercial code is appropriate in these circumstances, that Volkswagen has advanced no legitimate theory as to why special circumstances should be used, that the cases that they rely upon are readily distinguishable and involve situations where you have breach of warranty of title, stolen goods, you have an innocent seller. And in those cases, the courts were still looking for a remedy for the buyer. Volkswagen is attempting to do away with the remedy and in turn circumvent the language of the commercial code, which is to provide the aggrieved buyer with a remedy and for that remedy to be liberally administered. I think that the Court of Appeals decision was, frankly, on par. The Court of Appeals was, and if I see my time is up, if I may just finish, Chief Justice, your question. I think that the Court of Appeals decision was correct in all respects with the exception of the reference to Section 2304. I don't think that Section 2304 has any bearing, as my colleague agrees. However, and as I started off this argument, the only evidence in this record of damages is the evidence that the plaintiff put forward. And for that matter, summary judgment should have been denied. And we ask that we have the opportunity to go forward to present these tough facts, and admittedly tough facts, to the jury. Unless this court has any further questions, we would ask that the trial, that the appellate court's order reversing the trial court be affirmed.
So you agree with footnote 4 that says the court may, circuit court may have to start by addressing whether there's a breach?
If Volkswagen raises that issue, then absolutely they'll have to address that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Cochran, what kind of opinion do you want, other than, you know, you win at the end? But
any opinion with that result is
right. Outline it anyway.
I think Volkswagen has admitted throughout this case that we are asking this court to interpret the special circumstances clause, and in Wisconsin, that has not been done. So to some extent, the Court of Appeals did what it is supposed to do, which is not to create new law. What we are asking this court to do is to consider this special circumstances clause with these unique set of facts.
Would that allow the, let me ask you, how would that address the consumer's concerns about things like incidental consequential cover?
I certainly disagree with Councillor Cohn on the incidental consequences damages issue. He, in answer to your question, he stated that he would be able to bring in evidence regarding how many days it was out, what the person did in that time. The fact of the matter is he would not be able to bring in that evidence. The warranty plainly disclaims any incidental and consequential damages. And it says, I have it right here, it's in the record, it says, including out-of-pocket expenses for substitute transportation and lodging. So those things are specifically disclaimed. She is not able to recover those damages. Additionally, and Mr. Cohn does this for a living, and we certainly see him fairly often, and he is used to a typical motion in limine from us prior to court, which limits that testimony exactly. So she, so we would strenuously argue, and I think Mr. Cohn would agree, that the court would be asked not to let that testimony in. Incidental and consequential damages aren't recoverable. Those sorts of things, how many days it was out, what she had to do for substitute transportation, those things are not relevant to this case. In regard to cover,
what does limited warranty mean?
Excuse me?
What does limited warranty mean compared to full warranty?
It's limited because we don't warrant the vehicle to be, or Volkswagen does not warrant the vehicle to be free from defects. Volkswagen warrants that they will fix them free of charge if there are defects. Additionally, there are some things, wear and tear items, which are not specifically covered. So it is limited to some degree as opposed to a carte blanche. If anything's wrong, you get a new car warranty.
And I take it that the warranty says, and you also cannot present, we're not going to be responsible for, and if you accept the warranty, in other words, Volkswagen repairs the vehicle, you can't claim downtime and things like that. That's what you're saying?
That's right. It specifically says that you cannot.
Contractually, they cannot.
That's
once
right.
Once they accept the warranty and put it into play.
That's correct, Justice. In regard to cover, I think the cover analysis, again, illustrates how absurd this situation is. Mr. Cohen uses the example of the $25,000 car. Says she pays $25,000, gets $15,000, that's $10,000, less some diminution in use. Well, of course, you can't use the $25,000 as your initial number. If that was the case, she would be able to buy any car she wanted. She would be able to buy a $100,000 sports car and start at $100,000 minus $15,000, and then all of a sudden she has $85,000 in damages. That's not how cover works. If you're going to cover, you have to cover with a similar vehicle. In this case, if she wanted to cover, she would have had to have bought a Jetta or some similar car, a couple of years old, with 30,000 miles, and she would have had to pay whatever she would have paid for that, and we would have taken that number and subtracted what she received for the Jetta. Again, in this case, that would leave zero, because she received more than fair market value for the vehicle. If she would have bought a vehicle which was similar, which she is required to do to effectuate cover, she would have, in fact, paid less than what she received for her Jetta. She would, again, under cover, have no damages.
Aren't you subtracting it twice, though, because you're saying she's going to buy a 2-year-old vehicle? Doesn't under cover she reply buy similar goods to replace the used, the goods that are defective? And then there's a subtraction from that. You don't start out with a subtracted amount and then subtract what she got for it and say there's no damage.
She would have to buy a similar vehicle at that time. So she would have to, in fact, buy, again, not exactly, but she would have to buy a 2001 Jetta, 2 years old, with 32,000 miles, or obviously a vehicle similar to that. And the evidence, again, undisputed, admittedly so, shows that that would have been less than $15,000. So, no, you're not double subtracting it. If she would have paid $13,000 to buy cover. And
cover was a new vehicle. Cover wasn't a used vehicle. And I agree with you. She can't buy a Mercedes or a Porsche and call that cover and start from there. But I also don't think she covers with a used vehicle.
I disagree. I think that she has to buy similar goods. And at the time that she covered, that would be the similar good.
Just one last thing. Special circumstances. If we adopt, and you're drafting this opinion, if we do special circumstances the way you're asking us, will we be the first court to handle it in that manner?
If I may, Chief Justice, I think there are some cases, Valenti being one of them, the Harlan case, and as well as the two cases out of Pennsylvania, which I cited previously, which certainly imply, and one of them directly, the Harlan case, it says that if you have used the value and depreciated its use and gotten some use out of it, that you do fall into the special circumstances language. So I don't think you would be the first. I think perhaps we are the first court to look at it this specifically, but it certainly would not be totally out of left field. Chief Justice, if I can make one quick closing statement.
Quickly.
Mr. Cohen has stated that there are no facts in dispute. And there aren't. And he's admitted that he has a bad case. And he does. And Justice Prosser has commented, why in the world would this case ever get to a jury? And that is exactly why we are here, because there is no way that this case should ever get to a jury. Mr. Cohen is going to allow us to consider the $17,800 as the base price. $17,800 minus the $15,100 she received is $2,700. So she paid $2,700 to own a car for 2 years. That's a little over $100 a month to own a car, drive it for 32,000 miles, and yet she still gets to continue her case. That simply can't be the law in Wisconsin. It cannot happen. She has no damages in this case, and this court should reverse the Court of Appeals, reinstate Judge Frelick's opinion, and dismiss this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our discussion of 03-1621, Jessica Mayberry versus Volkswagen of America. We appreciate both of you coming today and discussing this provision in the UCC and in the Federal Act that the Court has not dealt with. Thank you. That ends our discussion. We'll take a few moments in recess to allow the students to leave and other students to come in.